Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking today about your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Pleased to have you back, Dr. Sandy. Welcome.
It is nice to be back, to get out of the clinic and not have to be dealing with fleas, which I'm seeing tons
of
for whatever. I have no idea why. There's so many great products out there. And I think people kind of think, you know, it's heading into fall. I can forget about that. But I've seen more flea cases in the last week and a half than I have all year. So it's flea season, so keep using your flea stuff if you've got pets that are going in and out.
And if you want to send your pet someplace, you can have your pet fly, maybe.
Yes, there's a new airline that opened up this spring, and it's kind of limited service. They go from D.C., New York, L.A., and then Chicago and Denver in between. And they cater to only pets. They call them passengers instead of passengers. They have their own special check-in gate. You just have to arrive with them on a leash or in your arms if you wish. And so they will be confined into carriers on the airplane, but they are where passengers would normally sit. So they've retrofitted these planes. Not inexpensive, but you do get first-class service for your pets. And so if you want to fly one way, New York to L.A., and again, no people on the plane except for the attendants and so on, it's $299 for your pet to be able to fly. So that's one way. So, yeah, they better hand out, you know, more than peanuts. You know, I'm not...
I would hope so.
Gourmet dog biscuits. Yay, there we go. Yeah.
We've had, of course, the news is full of stories about the swine flu and so forth that's going on, but there's a dog flu as well?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not that new a thing, but because of all the public interest in the swine flu, which started out in the swine, you know, population and jumped species to infect people, there was a equine flu virus, the H3N8 virus, that it was in just in horses and now is jumped species and is affecting dogs. We've known about it since about 2004, 2005.
Okay.
And there's been pretty well, you know, most of the outbreaks have been confined to big boarding kennels and tracks, like dog racing tracks and so on. But it's now been documented in over 30 states, and we have a dog population that has never been exposed to it. So they're kind of predicting over the last few years, we've been predicting that it's probably going to be growing, kind of like the way the swine flu is growing in the human population. They have come out, though, with a dog vaccine. It's got a conditional license. It is available. And you know, something that owners maybe want to talk to their veterinarian about. I don't want you to be paranoid, but because dogs don't wash their hands like we do or cover their coughs, it is more easily transmitted. So most dogs that get it end up just with a nasal discharge, nasty cough and a fever and a little supportive care, and they get over it, kind of like us with the flu.
Sure.
But, you know, elderly dogs, really young dogs, they could potentially be at risk.
Yeah. All right. Well, Bob in Eau Claire is online waiting to talk. So let's go to Bob. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I've got a 7-year-old golden retriever, she is our fourth golden retriever.
Okay.
Over about 35 years. And she has had a steady diet of science diet food throughout her lifetime. And the last 2 or 3 years, we were actually feeding her the Science Diet Light, which she responded to quite well. It was great for weight management, and things were going well. But she turned 7, and I thought, well, gosh, she's now considered a different age group.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would combine, kind of like mix in with the light, get the senior product for the science diet.
And let me guess, she gained some weight.
No, she stopped eating.
Or
she will not eat it readily.
Okay.
I mean, she does eat it eventually.
Okay.
But where she used to pretty much dive in at mealtime, now sometimes she'll go, you know, she won't touch her breakfast food until the middle of the afternoon.
Hmm.
And sometimes she'll leave her evening meal untouched until the morning.
You know, that's really strange. Most, like, Goldens and Labs and so on are such chow hounds that whenever I hear of a dog that loses its appetite, I always start thinking, you know, it's unlikely that it's that she's, you know, just food fixated on the light diet and doesn't like the senior. They tend to be pretty compatible, and most dogs will switch back and forth from one to the other without any trouble. But I, you know, and so if you haven't had her in for a good workover, you know, look over some lab work and so on, just to make sure that she's healthy and happy, because, you know, 7-year-old Golden, that's, you know, middle age, and that should be done. But it could just be that she's one of those rare and wonderful fussy golden retrievers. And by, you know, you could potentially stay on the light diet all her life. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about adding in some supplements that would be suitable for the older dogs, such as a joint supplement, some glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, maybe an antioxidant vitamin mix or something, because that tends to be what's different between the adult food and the senior food. What's interesting, too, is that the Science Diet Light is lower in calories than Science Diet Senior. And so when you first said you switched to Senior, I went, uh-huh, I bet she put on weight, because people will do that. They'll just feed the same amount thinking that, oh, this is what they need. And they plump up and their arthritis gets worse and they have more issues. So, you know, perhaps just go back to the light if that's what she likes. But also go in and get her checked over to make sure there's nothing wrong with her.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Heather in Ladysmith. Hi to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
We have got a little Shih Tzu. I think he's kind of a rescue dog. He's almost 2 years old, and he is eating clothes, especially underwear.
Ooh.
And shoes, loves shoes. You know, just go out, they went school shopping for 4 kids, and the brand new tennis shoes are coming out in his poop, but we're having to grab the poop to get all the poop out because it's...
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we have dogs that are indiscriminate when it comes to what they're chewing on, a couple of things we need to do. Number one is drastically change the environment. You said you have 4 kids. It's time to sit the family down and say, you know, doors are shut, clothes are in the closet, nothing's on the floor, shoes are put away, and then that way your dog isn't tempted. The other thing you need to do is make sure that you're providing your dog with some other outlet for chewing. And it may be that your dog would really like fleecy toys, but you have to be careful, because if he starts consuming those, I can just say you are lucky that your dog has not ended up under the knife of a surgeon for having an intestinal obstruction, because any of that stringy type stuff, it's really common to have it get wadded up and not be able to be passed. So at this point, you knock on wood, you've been a lucky pet owner, but I think it's time to, you know, make some, you know, puppy proof your house or dog proof your house to, and it's going to be harder to change the human behavior, I think, than the dog behavior. But, you know, just instead of, you know, fighting the issue, make sure that you're constantly, you know, using a lot of good surveillance and then redirecting your dog to appropriate items. So, yeah, I'm not a child psychologist, but perhaps there's some way that, you know, she could reward the appropriate behavior for the children, you know, like how to keep your rooms clean and things like that. That, you know,
that's not a bad
stuff
idea.
Isn't down on the floor, then, you know, for a day you get a sticker and then you get a bunch of stickers. Well, you know, whatever. I don't know. She can come up with her own plan of attack for her kids. So, yeah.
Good luck, Heather. Thank you for calling. Devin in Green Lake. On to you now. Hi, Devin.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a bunch of questions, but I'll just narrow it down to 2. I have an 11-year-old West Highland White Terrier named Wilson, and he is older, obviously. Mm-hmm. And my first question is, he's starting to get you know, that milky color in one of his eyes, and I believe it's cataracts, and is having troubles already. Like, I'll put a treat on the floor, and he really has to just sniff it out because he can't see it anymore.
Okay.
And wanted to know about cataract surgery. And then the second thing is having to do with his eyes as well, and it's on his paws because he's licking his paws, is the with Westies and the white dogs, that rusty, mm-hmm. you know, colored stain.
Yeah.
Wanted to know about that. I know that might have something to do with allergies or diet or what have you. So anyway.
Some very good questions. The first one regarding your dog's eyes. This should be something that your veterinarian could very easily diagnose. There's two conditions that can affect dogs' eyes that can make the lens look cloudy. And make sure that this is not corneal, like the clear surface on the front of your eye if you were to wear contacts where the contact would ride. That's called the cornea. If that's what's milky, you've got a problem. And I'd be taking your dog in to have that looked at. If for some reason your dog's got infiltrates into a part of the eye that shouldn't have anything covering it. If it is actually the lens, the part of the structure of the eye that is on the other side of the pupil, then it could potentially be a cataract. Cataracts can be caused by, you know, trauma to the eye. Sometimes dogs that are diabetic will develop cataracts. Sometimes it's just an inherited age-related type problem as well. Other times we'll see another condition that is normal for dogs as they age called nuclear sclerosis, which is where the lens just becomes more compact. They can still see. And the fact that your dog is being a little more visually impaired tells me that it may not be that. But most dogs, as they get older, their lens will look a little cloudy, but it doesn't impair their vision. So that would be something your veterinarian should be able to evaluate very quickly with an ophthalmoscope. If they can't see the retina clearly, then you probably have a cataract. Cataract surgery is not something that's done by most veterinarians. Veterinarians that do this type of surgery would be an ophthalmologist, and we have several in the state. So not just here in Madison, but I believe there's an ophthalmologist in Milwaukee area and up in the Green Bay area as well. So they're all over the place. The surgery that's done is similar to what they do in people. It's called phacoemulsification. They actually break the lens down and vacuum it out, for lack of a better way to describe it. Dogs do very well with this type of surgery. So get that checked out. And there's probably going to be some testing that they'd want to do before any surgery is done to make sure that your dog isn't a diabetic or that the retina itself is working fine. This is the problem. If if the retina, the nervous part of the eye is impaired as well, taking the lens out isn't going to make any difference because the dog's vision is still going to be impaired. So there's a little test that they do called an electroretinogram that, again, specialty clinics would have that equipment and be able to tell you if your dog's a good candidate for surgery. Regarding the paw licking and the rusty stain, all dogs have in their saliva a chemical called porphyrins. And when porphyrins, and it's not only in saliva, it's also in tears. So if you've ever seen dogs that have teary eyes, like little white poodles and so on, that have hair that may rub in their eye and they get a little extra watering, they get the rusty stain on their face, or if they're licking something around their feet or even around their muzzle. When porphyrins react to sunlight, they turn that kind of rusty brown color. So when I see rusty brown feet, that clues me in that I better look at those feet. It's possible that the dog licks out of, out of boredom, or maybe they hold their toy between their feet and get a little saliva transferred to it. But being a Westie, they are notorious for being dogs that are the textbook dog for dealing with allergies. And so if the feet are red, sore, moist, looking for secondary infections like yeast or bacterial infections, and actually addressing the allergies is the way to go. Just masking that rust stain color with whitening shampoos or some of the products that are on the market that help kind of bleach the coat probably isn't going to make any difference. So that's another thing that your veterinarian can have a look at, is between those toes, and collect some of that toe jam, have a look at under the microscope and see what bugs are there, and treat the condition appropriately.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take an email or two next, Dr. Sandy. And here's one from Katie, who writes about her in-laws who always had dachshunds but decided to get a golden doodle. And, you know, they went from a fairly easy and carefree grooming situation to a problem with this big dog who has a smell he can't get rid of. The entire house and the dog smells like wet dog.
Oh.
Any suggestions on how to keep a dog who gets wet a lot and drools quite a bit from smelling horrible?
Oh, you know, and this is, I mean, they went from a very short-haired dog to a dog that depends on how much poodle and how much golden is in the dog, whether they shed or they have that thick, dense hair coat. You know, I'd recommend, number one, keep the dog groomed, which means, you know, even though they look cute with curly hair, keep that hair cut short. So it means bathing and so on is going to be easier to do. When dogs with a lot of coat are jumping in some of the lakes and things around here, they pick up algae and some of the organic material, and then that kind of ferments in the hair coat and you get that yucky smell. So that may be all it is. But other places that you're going to want to look, from head to toe, I'd be really paying attention to the dog's mouth. Dogs that drool a lot will sometimes get an inflammation or infection in that lip fold. And so that can be a source of kind of a cheesy, foul odor. Make sure that the dog's teeth are being brushed, that you don't have periodontal disease. And then as the dog is drooling, they're leaving that smelly bacteria all over itself if it's licking its feet or the rest of its body. If it's a swimming dog, and especially somebody like a golden doodle, make sure that those ears are being kept clean. Some of the dogs that have more poodle in them will have a lot of hair in the ears, and that can trap moisture, and you'll get secondary yeast infections, and that can be smelly. So have a pay attention to the ears and take a whiff there. Like the last caller talking about the dog licking their feet with allergies, check that too. Golden retrievers are one of those dogs that we see a lot of allergies in, and that doesn't mean that just because they're a golden doodle, they don't have more the golden type traits with being allergic. So check to make sure that the dog's feet aren't inflamed, because that can be a source of odor as well. And then lastly, look at the rear end and make sure that those anal glands are kept empty and that fecal material and stuff isn't around that hairy butt that's back there, and keep it clean. So these are high maintenance dogs. Yeah. You know, people get them and they think, oh, they don't shed. Well, guess what? You got to go to the groomer all the time with them to be able to have them be a comfortable dog. I mean, I used to have Basset hounds, and hounds have a very distinctive odor. And people would ask me, well, what did you do with it? And I said, well, I'd bathe them before I visit my mother-in-law. But you just, you know, because she couldn't handle it, but you just get used to it. And so it's, you know, it's one of those things that they do have a distinctive odor, and, you know, enjoy them. And, you know, but there is a product they may want it. One quick little thing. Okay.
All right.
My favorite anti-odor eliminator is called AOE, Animal Odor Eliminator. So
AOE.
It comes in a spray. It comes in a concentrate you can mix up. Love it. Love it. Love it. It really, really works, and it doesn't leave like a perfumey smell. It doesn't just mask it. It actually changes it biologically. So that would be something to look into.
Trin in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Trin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a wonderful 15-year-old cat that we just took in from my parents' house about 2 weeks ago. And he had to leave their home because he had trouble using his litter box and was peeing all over the house. And my mom just couldn't handle it anymore. They tried putting him on some Prozac or something like it. They tried some antibiotics in case he had maybe a urinary infection or something of the sort, and nothing seemed to be working, and their other option was to put him to sleep. And
oh, my goodness.
Handle that.
Yeah.
So we have him here now in La Crosse, and he's so wonderful, but he's starting to do the same thing in our home.
All right. Whenever
we don't own our home, we're renters.
Yeah.
And so I can't deal with it the way that maybe a typical homeowner could.
Right, right. Whenever I hear a story of an elderly cat, and 15 years old is definitely in the senior realm. And just, you know, first of all, you need to be congratulated for trying to take this cat on. But I would definitely recommend that this kitty be worked up for medical issues, not just have antibiotics thrown at it, not be put on a psychoactive drug, but, you know, look at some of the more common conditions that can cause a cat to not want to use the litter box. One is if the cat is hyperthyroid. Sometimes kitties that are hyperthyroid will be metabolically stressed and will start urine marking and not using their litter box. Sometimes cats that have kidney disease where they're maybe not concentrating their urine as well have to go to the bathroom more frequently, and just physically, because they're arthritic, can't make it to the litter box. So sometimes we have to provide these elderly cats with a litter box in every room of the house or in on every floor, easy access, kind of a low profile entry so they can get in and out if the kitty is showing some signs of being arthritic. If the cat can't jump up on the beds easily or up on the kitchen counter, then I'd be thinking that, you know, arthritis may be adding to part of this as well. Once, you know, you've ruled out medical causes, then we start looking at what can we do from the behavior standpoint. And yes, it may mean changing the way you want to dress it, where you don't want to have a litter box in your living room, but hey, guess what? We're going to have one because it helps prevent the problem. So sitting down with someone that can do a good behavioral history to find out just exactly what the cat's doing. Are they spraying, where they're backing up and hitting vertical objects with urine, or are they actually squatting? Are they still using the box for defecating? More about what size of box you're using, where the boxes are located, how many you have, the type of litter you use, what you've done to try to deal with it, the cleaning agents you're using. I mean, these can be fairly long, involved appointments, but usually we can, you know, try to come up with a behavior modification program that more involves changing your behavior with how you manage your cat and not having the cat live up to your expectations, but you living up to the cat's expectations. So I know that sounds like, you know, putting it back on you again, but, you know, those would be things that I'd be looking at. And
all right, and it's good luck.
Just thank one of those you. Things we have to do when our cats get older. I remember having an 18-year-old cat, and I had to have a litter box in my bathroom next to my bed because he would be on the bed and he'd have to jump off and like, I got to go now because I'm not concentrating my urine, and if he didn't have it, he would pee in the corner. And it was much easier to clean a litter box than carpeting. Yeah.
Well, we're willing to try anything.
Good.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling, Trin. Appreciate your call. Good for you for trying to help out that kitty. Lynette in Hubertus, on to you. Hi, Lynette.
Good morning. I have two questions completely unrelated to each other. The first one, I've got a fairly new year-old, what I would guess is a Min Pin mixed with a rat terrier or some sort of a terrier. She's 22 pounds. Her name is Shelby, and potty training has not been going well. So I took a urine sample in, and they discovered some crystals. Not sure what kind. Struvite or Stuvite crystal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so now she's on the antibiotics, Clavamox, and we're about halfway through, and it seems to have helped because, you know, now her flow is a lot bigger than these small little amounts.
Okay.
But she seems to have only a two-hour window regardless.
Okay.
And it's a two-hour window, and that's it. And I'm wondering if we're still dealing with the crystals and that she has to go every 2 hours.
Yeah.
Or am I back to dealing with the potty training? Is it more behavioral or is it medical?
Good question. And I think the best way to decide whether it's going to be a medical problem or a behavior problem is take the urine in the container that Mother Nature wants it in the bladder. Okay, I'm sorry to put it that way, but you got to take your dog into the clinic. Just delivering a urine sample. The big problem with dropping off a urine sample is that you've collected it in a container. It's flowed outside the dog's body, and it can pick up bacteria and stuff there. And any time we take a urine sample, just about anything for dogs or cats, and let it come to room temperature or refrigerate it, minerals can come out of solution and form crystals. So just because they saw crystals doesn't mean that that's the cause of the problem. And the antibiotics that she's on, Clavamox, will not get rid of crystals. That is an antibiotic for an infection. So I'm wondering if it's just not appropriate for you to go back in and say, look, get a sterile sample right from my dog's bladder and look at it hot off the press and still see if you see anything there. If they're still seeing crystals, if there's bacteria present, then they can culture the urine and find out if that's an appropriate antibiotic for your dog to be on. If they're seeing crystals, you may want to look at having a workup done, such as an abdominal x-ray or an ultrasound, to see if she actually has bladder stones. If she's got some stones sitting in her bladder, then that may be why she doesn't have good holding capacity, because she's got these other things sitting there that's kind of taking up space and she can't hold as much urine. So that would be the, you know, one of the first things I do is say, before you start looking at, you know, changing what you're doing for potty training, you know, really rule out, is there a medical problem there or not? And that's what I would be doing. That's what I'd be recommending. So,
okay, very good. My second question is relating to human toxic foods, and when does it warrant a trip to the emergency? I mean, we all know about chocolate, and Shelby got into my baking cabinet and ate about 3 ounces, 3.5, 4 ounces of 60% cocoa chocolate.
Ooh.
And she did, and I took her in 12 hours. She was there doing through all the IVs and and charcoal and everything else. And, you know, she's fine.
Yeah.
But in the future, what foods and what amount, basically, are considered toxic and do require a $500 visit?
That's a really good question, because every dog is different. And I tend to say, even just a small amount of any of the thing that we look at as potentially being toxic, you need to seek veterinary attention. To give you an example, that chocolate that your dog got, if it was milk chocolate, may not have been an issue. But if it's like the high octane chocolate, and especially some of the new, you know, 70% cocoa and so on chocolates that are out there, they can be, you know, quite toxic. Like the unsweetened baking chocolate, 1/10 of an ounce per pound of body weight. So one little cube of that chocolate could have been enough to, cause your dog some, you know, major, major health issues. So you did the right thing taking them in. And that's what emergency clinics are there for, is to call. Other things that you need to be aware of, raisins and grapes, very toxic for dogs, not for other species. We eat them fine. Birds can eat them. Cats can eat them. Not a big deal. But, you know, and it seems to be that it's dog related. Some dogs will go into kidney failure just eating a handful of raisins. Others may not have any issues at all. And there's no way of knowing until you go in and you start monitoring their lab work. And so that's why they need to stay in the hospital. Macadamia nuts. Oh, I love macadamia nuts. Toxic for dogs. Who would have thought that? But, you know, that we see a paralysis type syndrome for dogs that get into macadamia nuts. And again, dosage is very, extremely variable. Other thing that we've seen a lot more of is xylitol toxicity. It's a sweetener that's used in a number of, you can buy it in health food stores and grocery stores now as a sweetener for your coffee and things and baking, but you can also get it in gum. And, you know, just leaving a pack of gum in your car and having your dog in your car, there's enough in a pack of gum, even just 2 or 3 sticks could be enough to put your dog into a hypoglycemic state. It drops the blood sugar in dogs for some reason. They can seizure and die. So, you know, I think it's just, if you're a pet owner, you got to do your homework. Like, you know, I can't have avocados in my house because if my birds get them, it could cause death in my birds. So
I
do you know
that
avocados are toxic for not all birds, but some birds, you know? And
didn't
so,
know that.
Yeah. So I think that's part of being a good pet owner, is doing your homework ahead of time. So.
And thanks a lot, Lynn, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Cheryl in Superior is up next with a question. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thank you. First, I had two cats that had cystitis, and what I discovered was dry cat food. I got them on the IAMS or the Science Diet, and that cured it. I didn't have to have those emergency vet bills and all of the urination all over the house. That's
okay.
The first thing. And the second thing I'm actually calling about is my friend has a toy poodle. She can't call because she's on an airplane right now. But he has warts and can't get rid of them, and he licks them to the point of infection, and they really bother him.
Okay.
What can a person do to help a dog with warts?
Well, let me go back to your comment on cystitis. All that, when we hear the word as a veterinarian, cystitis, that just means inflammation of the bladder. And inflammation of the bladder can be due to a whole host of things from, you know, yes, crystals and stones and so on banging around in there and causing some troubles, to urinary tract infections, which are pretty uncommon in young cats, older cats much more common, to in some cats we will see just a inflammatory bladder wall problem that we can never identify what the cause is, usually stress related. And so you found an answer for your cats, and that's great. But, you know, don't think that that's going to be the cure-all for every cat that's out there, because you still need to find out what is causing the cystitis. As to the toy poodle, I really have to wonder if they're truly warts. Dogs do get a papillomavirus, and typically most of the dogs that get papillomas will be young dogs. It's usually in their mouth. Sometimes you can see them in other parts of their body. They look like a wart that a human would get, where it's kind of a little dried finger-like projections of tissue. But most poodles that I see, what owners call warts are actually a type of skin tumor called a sebaceous adenoma or some other type of skin tumor. It's common for dogs to get lots of these all over where the sebaceous glands grow, and they can become inflamed and get infected and bother the dog. And sometimes what we're looking at is more surgical removal. Most dogs aren't bothered by them, but if they're nicked by the groomer or they're in a spot that the dog can worry it, then we sometimes have to take them off. So then if you're going to be taking them off, good idea to get them biopsied so that you know exactly what you're dealing with, because there's some other look-alike skin masses as well.
All right.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call as well. Tom in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, emailed us and says, my vet talked me out of vaccinating my dog for Lyme disease. Said the treatment is less expensive than the vaccination, and dogs usually don't suffer too badly if they get it. He said, also said large and giant breed dogs would be least likely to suffer from discomfort due to that. Is he full of beans? What difference would size of dog have to do with anything except paying for larger doses of anything?
Yeah. You know, Lyme disease is a real entity, and we do see it, although many dogs that get exposed never show clinical signs. So we see lots and lots and lots of exposure, but not a whole lot of disease. But when we do see disease, for some dogs, it can be quite devastating. The dogs have a syndrome that affects their kidneys, and it can put them into kidney failure, and it's not a nice way to go. I've had several patients die from what's called Lyme nephritis. It can cause an inflammatory joint disease as well, but I think it's definitely one of those diseases that's overtreated and sometimes overdiagnosed. It really depends on where you live and what the incidence of Lyme disease is in your area. And maybe where you live in the state, it's at a very low area, low level, and your veterinarian isn't comfortable with doing the vaccination. I'm tongue-tied because it is a controversial thing. The American Veterinary College of Internal Medicine came out with a statement, a Lyme statement, on testing and vaccinating and so on. And they basically agreed to disagree. There's two camps out there, and these are the researchers and the big internal medicine people. And even in that group of types of people, they cannot come up with a uniform idea of how we should be approaching Lyme disease. The vaccines that are out there are safe. We have one now that's a new type of vaccine that's called an OSP-A and C vaccine, something to talk to your veterinarian about. But I do it on a case-by-case basis. I don't vaccinate every dog for Lyme. I don't vaccinate my own dogs, but I think that there are certain dogs that are at higher risk, and the vaccine, because of the low risk, may be something they'd want to consider using.
Okay. Let's go to Kate in Madison now. Kate, hello to you.
Hi. I have a 12-year-old female cat, one of two females, their sisters. She was the run of the litter, and she's always been bow-legged. But the last year and a half or so, she started to limp on the back leg. And we've had her into the doctor, and, of course, when she goes to the vet, the adrenaline's high. She doesn't limp.
Mm-hmm.
They're having trouble evaluating this. And, it's worse in the morning, and by evening, she's fine. She's tearing around.
Mm-hmm.
She is an indoor-outdoor cat who's on an invisible fence, and when she's outside, she's seeking warm concrete or warm soil.
Okay.
Where she tends to nap and get that hip down into, a warm spot.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, this problem of it not happening when you go to the vet, And how should this be evaluated?
Yeah, you know, and that is true for cats. I mean, usually we've got both extremes. The cat that just hunkers down on the table and says, yeah, I may limp at home, but I'm not walking in here, to the cat that is flying around the room and is terrified and, like you said, has the adrenaline going through their system and they're not going to display the symptoms that they are at home. One, you can videotape your cat. We have no problems at all with, you know, bringing in videos. Here's my cat limping, so we can see kind of what they're doing. But in many cases, we have to go by what the owner is describing. And getting an x-ray done to see, you know, does your kitty have visible arthritic changes in the joints? That may be helpful. And so that may require that your cat be sedated a little bit to be able to get good x-rays. While they're sedated, having a good feel of all those joints to see if there's any laxity. The fact that she's been bow-legged all her life, I wonder if she's got like kneecaps that are out of place. Sometimes we see that in patients. They're just born with a deformity in their knee that doesn't allow the kneecap to sit where it should. And that may have been causing some angular issues with the other joints to compensate for it, and so they may be aged a little more prematurely. Cats do get arthritis. Because dogs are walked on leashes and tend to be out and doing more things, most owners will see it and bring it to our attention faster than cat owners do. But things that you could talk to your veterinarian about would be, you know, putting her on a glucosamine chondroitin sulfate supplement. Sometimes some cats will do well on that. If she's healthy and her kidneys and liver are working fine, there is an approved non-steroidal anti-inflammatory for use in cats called meloxicam that we use fairly frequently in cats, but being 12 years old, you want to make sure that she's healthy before she gets started on it. Don't just be grabbing things that you would give to a dog or to yourself, because cats are very unique in the way they handle most of the pain medication that we use. Those things may help and give your cat a good quality of life. So I think that would be the way to go, is ask your veterinarian for radiographs and maybe a little lab work and start her on some medication.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Kate, for calling. And Tammy in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, good morning. Love the show. I wait all week long to hear the show.
Thank you.
I was wondering, I have two quick questions about my beautiful 1.5-year-old pit bull that we adopted from the Humane Society. First question is, we have spent hundreds and hundreds of dollars on toys for her, extreme toys.
Uh-huh.
She's a very, you know, vigorous chewer. I've even gone to the extent of ordering the balls that they give to lions in the zoo.
Uh-huh.
And she's just shredding them.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you have any suggestion on any kind of toy that...
Well, I can tell you what I did for my bulldog, Lydia, who's passed away a few years ago, but her favorite toy was a bowling ball. That was the only thing...
Yeah, that's like my last resort. I haven't done it yet.
Yeah,
but
that was one of the only things that I could give her that she couldn't destroy. Some of these toys that they say, you know, like there's one that's a really big, hard plastic ball. She would still manage to, you know, get her teeth into that. Basketball, she would pop anything.
Yep.
And you have to be careful, because some of the really hard toys that are out there, like Nylabones and you know, the really durable hard stuff, fracture teeth. And she's a young dog, and you don't want to see those big chewing teeth, because they require those to function, get broken. So I went with a bowling ball, and I have as a monument to her a bowling ball as a reflecting ball in my garden, still sitting there. But she would just push that around for hours, and I mean, there were teeth marks in it where she would just, you know, get it up against something and grind her incisors against it, and wasn't the best for teeth, but it was the only thing I could give her.
Okay, so I'll try the bowling ball. I don't suggest going to lacrosse balls, because she does like something that has a little bit of a give, so she can chew on it, but you know, half an hour they're shredded.
Yeah, it's really tough to find things that are not going to get broken, and you know, the real durable Kongs, I've seen dogs eat through those.
Kongs, through that one.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's a couple of Frisbees out there that I've seen them do demos where they drop a, you know, a weighted board with nails in it to mimic a dog's teeth and it not puncturing it. The Hyperflight people that make the flying discs have one.
Okay.
And my dog still managed to get holes in it. But, you know, it lasted longer than anything else. So that might be another thing to look at. Some of the fire hose type material toys. I don't know if you've tried those, but
I tried those too. Like you say, I don't know if they make them or somebody refurbs them for them. But tried that and she got right through that one.
Yeah, there's other toys called tire biters, which are made of tire, like the black tire material that.
Yeah, I tried that too. Had holes in it with 10 minutes.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm
sorry. I mean, so, but I don't recommend bowling balls in the house. That was like we had to draw the line. All the toys go outside. Yeah.
Thanks, Tammy.
Another quick question, real quick, is she gets button tumors. She had one on the top of, or, you know, her bottom of her lip.
Yeah.
And they actually had to aspirate that with some steroids to get it to go away.
Uh huh.
And she recently just got another one about the size of a peanut M&M.
Okay.
And I was just keeping my eye on it, and you know, didn't want to put her through all that again. And it actually went down and went away.
Yeah. This is
there anything I can do to prevent that or help her with that? Or
they're a really common tumor in young dogs, and they're called a histiocytoma. The nickname is a button tumor because they sometimes will. Well, they'll become a little skin mass that will ulcerate and have look like a little round button. We joke about these that they're one of these tumors that we have to hurry up and get it off because it's a surgical emergency. Because if we don't get it off, we're going to lose our opportunity to take it off because they come off, they just disappear on their own, as you found out. So it's a joke. Okay, sorry. But there are other tumors that can look just like this. So don't assume every time she gets one, if it's not going away or if it's bothering her, there's other tumors like mast cell tumors and, you know, basal cell tumors and other things that can look just like it. And they can be a lot more problematic to deal with. So, you know, I think it's always a good idea to get them checked out.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Tammy, for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today as we talk your pet's health, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of questions here for Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. And Sandy, we've got an email from Sue wondering when interviewing or touring a prospective vet's office, what should a person be asking and looking for?
Well, I think use your senses, okay? Does it smell? I mean, there's always going to be a little bit of like medicinal smell and so on. You'd want to look at what the kennels are like. I think it's great that a vet clinic, I mean, I personally, I would never board my dog at a facility unless I saw, was able to go back and see what the facility was like. And I think the same should be true for a vet clinic, that we should be, you know, veterinarians and vet staff should be very open to say, you know, if you want to see the place. I mean, obviously, we do have some, we have to abide by the privacy laws. That same true with, you know, just like with people, you know, we can't show you other medical records or talk to you about other cases without getting the permission of the owner. And so, you know, having you, you know, poke your fingers in cages and so on, you obviously can't do that kind of stuff. But, you know, getting a tour, asking your veterinarian, you know, about, you know, equipment and things that they may have, like what kind of anesthetic equipment do they have? Do they use a gas? I mean, I don't know a vet clinic that doesn't have a gas anesthetic machine, but, you know, do they have different things to meet the different needs of different patients? Is there somebody there observing the animals at night? What do they do for emergencies? You know, who answers the phone call? Do they get transferred someplace else? Are you comfortable with that emergency clinic? Is it close to where you're working or where you're, you know, you live so you don't have to travel too far? You know, I think it comes down to just the bedside manner. Do you like the staff? Are they courteous and friendly? Do they answer your questions? There is one organization that is available for veterinarians to have their hospital certified by, and it's called the American Animal Hospital Association. And you may see that in the logo of the clinic. It says AHA, American Animal Hospital Association. And they, you know, to be able to get that certification requires that they meet certain medical record standards, continuing education, and like what books and so on and journals that they get, cleanliness, ventilation, x-ray equipment, lab testing, all those things are things that get evaluated. And I don't know if you really need to go into that much detail, but, you know, that's the kind of stuff I'd be looking at. Yeah.
Willem in Colfax, it's your turn now. Hi, Willem.
Hi, I'm calling about our cat. We don't know exactly how old he is because he was a stray, but I'd say he's around 8 years old. And recently he's lost some weight, and he's had some problems with his digestion. I know it's lunch hour, so
okay.
I don't know the details, but
okay.
So he had his blood work and everything came up fine, and I was wondering, he was in a fight earlier this summer, and he was on antibiotics for a while. I know that people can sometimes have their intestinal system, you know, messed up by antibiotics. Does that happen to cats ever? Or could that be a problem that he has some sort of bowel infection or something?
Well, it can, and sometimes we do find that putting pets on a probiotic. There's one that I know that I was put on not too long ago called Florigen, but in the pet world, there's two on the market now, one by the Iams company called Prostora, which is a tableted form, another one by Nestle Purina called Fortiflora. It comes in little granular packages that you sprinkle on their food, and some pets will do better with that. But, you know, I'm not sure what lab tests have been done, and, you know, sometimes if your cat has, you know, chronic gastrointestinal problems, you know, looking at if it's an indoor outdoor cat and it's getting into fights, you know, is it, you know, been treated for intestinal parasites? Have you had your kitty screened for feline leukemia and feline immunodeficiency virus, FIV? That's how they get it, is usually through contact with other cats. And that's the guideline right now, is to, after a fight, usually like 6 to 8 weeks later, we want to be drawing blood from these kitties to be able to check to make sure that they haven't been exposed. So, checking on what lab work was done, an older, you know, a cat that you don't know the age, you adopted as an adult, could be much older. And so if they didn't do a thyroid level, make sure that gets checked out. You know, and then we get into some of the weird and wonderful GI workup tests that look at cobalamin and folate, and is the pancreas working all right? And, you know, so there's a whole bunch of gastrointestinal testing we can start looking into as well. And I don't know if that's the kind of stuff that you've gone through, but if it's just been kind of the basic, you know, your cat's liver and kidneys are working fine, time to go back to the drawing board and start looking at some of these other things as well.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And Mary and Nina, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good afternoon. I was at my vet's office yesterday, and there was a poster for DNA testing to determine the breeds in your mutt.
Okay.
And they said, you know, one of the benefits is to know the different breeds so that you can better deal with behavior and possible health issues.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good thing to do?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you brought this up, because the last vet meeting that I went to, the people that it's the Mars company that have used the Canine Genome Project and have come up with this test that's called the Wisdom Test. I think it's called the Wisdom Test. And they're able to look at mixed breed dog heritage and come up with, you know, a list of different dogs. And I've had a few people send them in and we get some results back, like, what? You've got what in you? And, you know, and to look at the dog, it's like, you know, something, I mean, either something's wrong or, you know, this dog just didn't read the book on, you know, how to beat a pug or whatever, because it's a, you know, 120-pound dog, and we're getting all these, like, little dog, you know, breeds showing up in their wisdom panel. But I went to a meeting, and they had a mixed breed dog there, and they were having veterinarians guess the breed, and you had to guess the top two breeds, and I won. Yay! Okay. It was Bernese Mountain Dog and Plot Hound mix. And so they sent me a free test kit, and I have a woman that I work with, sent her dog in, and her blood from her dog. It's a little blood test. I'm not sure what the cost to the consumer is. I think it's like $100, $150. Sorry, I don't do pricing. But you can go on their website and you can find out and actually order a test kit to take into your clinic if you want. And she found out that her dog has Cocker Spaniel and Border Collie in it. And I don't know if it's going to change anything we're currently doing for the dog, but it kind of opened up her eyes to why the dog's got the hair coat it does and why it likes to herd. So, you know, and so sometimes it's just more kind of coffee table, you know, or sitting around the dining room table. Hey, guess what's in my dog? To answer some of those questions. It's probably uncommon that we're going to be, you know, finding out about any health issues that a mixed breed dog is going to be unique to that particular dog. So, you know, go ahead and do it if you got a couple $100 you want to spend. And yeah,
there you go.
And then, you know, and you go in with it realizing that, I don't know if I'm going to be really happy with the results. Yeah.
Great.
Thank you very much.
And
you could put your own contest on, Mary, and charge, let's say, $1 a guess or something.
Well, we did. We actually did. I put up posters, and I said, guess the breed, you know, and with Mary's dog while we were waiting for the results to come back. And we got all kinds of weird things. And, you know, I had a prize for somebody, and it was just kind of one of those fun things we did at the vet school. And, yeah.
Good time. Leanne in Fish Creek, on to you. Thanks, Leanne, for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if Dr. Sandy could enlighten me as to what would cause a dog to pool blood internally other than rat poison.
Ooh. Well, you know, when we see dogs that get exposed to the rodenticides that like warfarin and so on, that can cause bleeding because it does affect clotting factors. But there's a number of other things that can cause dogs to bleed internally. Probably one of the more common reasons is a tumor called a hemangiosarcoma, or sometimes we'll even see the benign version called hemangioma. They're tumors of blood vessels, and so obviously they're very fragile. And most dogs can truck along with these just fine, and it's one of the more common causes of acute death, especially in large breed dogs, where they, you know, maybe just, you know, bump their abdomen, even just gently on something. If they've got a mass on their spleen, it can rupture and they bleed into their abdominal cavity. So I'm unsure whether, you know, this was a, you know, your dog that was bleeding like this.
It was a little Chihuahua and was perfectly healthy the night before, and I picked him up, and he just had copious amounts of blood coming out of his mouth and nose.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, I mean, we do see, like, hemophilia in dogs. There's, you know, there's other illnesses and things that can consume clotting factors. So, you know, I always recommend when we have a case like this, if your dog survived, that, you know, good, you know, getting some other diagnostics done to see, do they have a nasal tumor that's bleeding, an oral mass that's bleeding. If they died, get an autopsy done. Answers lots of questions and puts your mind at rest. And it really helps you give closure.
Have been an aneurysm? Do dogs get aneurysms?
They can, but unlikely. It, you know, be more common to be like a nasal tumor or something like that was bleeding.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks for listening in. I'm Larry Mueller, and really glad to be here and have Sandy with us today to answer your questions. Lots of callers online, so we'll just shoot right back to the let's shoot back to the phones. I'll turn on your microphone.
Okay, there we go.
There we go. Dennis in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you Blasto? I've got nothing but problems with Blasto. We lost one dog about 20 years ago. We re-landscaped everything. We live out in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we've lost, well, my granddaughter lost her dog. And I was told, well, female dogs don't get it as often. We've got one dog that's been with us for 17 years in the same environment and has never caught Blasto.
Yeah.
What is the answer, and is there ever going to be a vaccine?
Probably not a vaccine. It's a, you know, as you know, it's a fungal infection that lives in the soil. And it's very common in northern Wisconsin. We don't see a lot of it down in this area. Most of the dogs that come in contact with it, you know, they start to wonder, do they have some type of an immune deficiency or a unique immune problem that other dogs don't? Because, you know, why do some get it and others don't? It can be lifestyle dependent in that, you know, if it's a dog that's more of a couch potato versus a dog that's a hunting dog that's got his nose to the ground and actually inhaling spores, they may be more, you know, more at risk to it. Shy of saying move from that area, I wish I could tell you what, you know, it is, you know, just there's hotbeds of it, and There's no way of knowing which dog is going to be at risk compared to the other. So,
But probably less likely a hunting dog. If you had a hunting dog, you're more likely probably.
Just because they're out in the and their noses to the ground versus, you know, the little dog that's carried around and on the grass in your backyard and not going anywhere. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling, Dennis. Mike in Antigo, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I've got a 6.5-year-old chocolate lab with arthritis in her front right shoulder. When she was a pup about 6 months old, she had shoulder ligaments and stuff, and then now it turned into arthritis, I guess.
Yeah, anytime that a joint is traumatized or you have some cartilage abnormalities, especially with large breed growing dogs, you can run into, shoulder, elbow, hip, knee problems and so on. You damage the joint. That's what the Mother Nature tries to do, is lay down new bone tissue to try to stabilize it. And that results in, discomfort and things that you may want to consider. I brought this up with, some of the arthritic cat talks that we had last hour. But, some of the joint supplements, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, there's a whole bunch of them out there. Pain management. Look into making sure that your dog's weight is normal. So many dogs are overweight, and if we can just get the weight off of them, they do a whole lot better with getting around, and it helps decrease some of the discomfort. So make sure your dog's body condition score is a 4 or 5 out of 9, and your veterinarian can tell you that. Look into alternative therapy as well, things like acupuncture, chiropractic care, if it's like a especially back problems and so on, may be helpful. There are joint diets on the market as well that are rich in antioxidants that help a lot of these dogs. So there's a whole range of things that we can do, even working with physical therapists that can teach you to do certain exercises with your dog to help maintain mobility of that joint.
Well, she's a hunting dog, and it's bird season's coming up, but when she runs really hard, then she limps pretty bad, and then sometimes she doesn't limp, but I've had her on glucosamine tablets, glucosamine dog biscuits, 100% cod liver oil.
Dog food. You may find that your veterinarian may need to be prescribing an anti-inflammatory then. If she gets that sore, treating her before and maybe after a hunting trip, you may find that that'll make her feel more comfortable. But
you know, about giving her aspirin or something.
Yeah, be careful with aspirin because it can cause ulcerations in dog's stomachs. There's some drugs that are actually licensed for dog use that are going to be safer than aspirin. But, don't just assume that it's arthritis. If she does have a joint mouse, meaning
they did
a little
for x-rays.
They did.
I had her in for x-rays, and they told me it's arthritis.
It's arthritis, okay.
Yeah, they showed me the spot of arthritis. I was wondering if they can do a cortisone shot for the dog.
Well, they sometimes can do that as well. But you may want to consider even a referral to an orthopedic surgeon. Sometimes these joints, they can do arthroscopic surgery, go in, clean up some of the damage that's been done, and some of these dogs do much better after that as well. So, don't just think you got to be throwing drugs at the dog. There are other, modalities of treatment that surgery, as well as some of the alternative therapies that may help.
Good luck.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Marge emailed to say, Lily, the cat is 22 or 23 and has kidney problems. We don't want to do any subcutaneous stuff that will hurt her more than it's worth. Is there a way to keep her comfortable?
Well, I think the big things for kitties that are that age with kidney failure is to make sure that they're staying well hydrated. And yes, sometimes they just make so much urine that we need to supplement them with subcutaneous fluids. And it's not that bad. Most cats tolerate it very well. And I think it's more of the owner getting over the squeamishness of doing it. But I think it's worthwhile considering that. But if she'll eat canned food, especially canned food that you've added water to, like a kidney diet you've added water to and made it into more of a soupy type texture, that can increase the water that she's taking in orally. Make sure that her potassium level is staying normal. These cats really need extra potassium. Don't just throw it at her. Make sure that you're monitoring those levels. Check her phosphorus level. That should be part of the, standard blood testing and so on. Like I said, keep her hydrated. No stress in her life. So I wouldn't be traveling with her or doing anything that would maybe throw off her taking in water on a regular basis, because that can push them over the edge as well.
Susan in Partyville, on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have had a number of pets over the years. And so have had to put some to sleep.
Yeah.
And that has always been a peaceful process.
Yeah.
And a couple months ago, we had to have our German Shepherd put down, and it hurt him, and it was very traumatic.
Huh.
And I had never experienced anything like that before.
Okay.
And so I wondered, is that a common thing, or did something go wrong?
Yeah, it isn't. And sometimes, you know, depending on the temperament of the dog, When I'm ending a pet's life, typically what I will do, this is always really hard to talk about, but yeah. I will put in an intravenous catheter. I just find that that gives me good access to a vein. Using a needle or a little butterfly catheter, you can run the risk of having it slip out of place, and the material that's injected can burn and be painful if it's sliding out of the vein. So.
What happened?
Yeah,
I'm sure
yeah, and so that's why I just say, you know what, it's worth it for me to, and even though it may be the prick of having a little catheter put in, it's much, you know, nicer than you can hold the dog if they wiggle. I don't have to worry about venous access. The other thing that I will do is I like to, before I give the fatal solution to the dog is or cat, is give them an injection of usually an anesthetic agent that just calms them down. The one that I love to use is called propofol. It's a white, milky type solution. Many humans that have undergone anesthesia will have that being given to them as well. And we joke and call it milk of amnesia because it looks just like milk, but it just takes that excitement phase out. They just kind of settle down and are relaxed, and they can put their head in the owner's lap. And then when I give the injection where that really counts, I don't have to worry about them wiggling or you know, getting upset. Some dogs and cats that are just given the euthanasia fluid will have an excitement phase, and that's one of the other reasons why I use it. It is they kind of fight the initial feel of it, of, you know, getting sedated, and that's where using something like propofol ahead of time really helps make things go a lot smoother.
Well, now, this was the first shot. It wasn't the actual shot that puts them to sleep.
Okay.
I think it was intended to be comfort, you
okay.
know, or an anesthetic kind of thing.
Okay, okay.
But it didn't go well.
It didn't go well. And, you know, and that's something that is, from a veterinarian's point of view, the worst thing that can happen. And, you know, I always sit down and I talk to owners about, you know, what can happen so that there's less surprises, that there may be a little bit of an excitement phase, that, you know, usually I know the patients well and I know how they've reacted in the hospital before. And so it's, you know, if your dog was a nervous Nelly in the clinic before, sometimes giving them even like a little Valium ahead of time helps relieve some of the anxiety. You know, every case is handled a little bit differently. And I am so sorry things didn't go well. And this is not the norm. But, you know, it's, you know, obviously it was, you know, very emotional thing for you to have to go through. And, you know, it may be worthwhile just talking to your veterinarian and say, do you remember, like, what, you know, what happened and what can we do differently in the future so that, you know, and I hope you will get another pet at some point. If you do have to go through this, maybe you can make some requests like pre-sedation, or I'll pay extra for an IV catheter or whatever it may take. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email here from someone whose son has two cats about a year old that, according to the vet, have blood in their urine.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been through many tests and several bouts with antibiotics. It's a fairly expensive process. Doctors haven't been able to locate the cause. The vet mentioned exploratory surgery as the next option.
Ooh, ooh.
This is very expensive. The cats are healthy. They eat or act healthy. They eat well and are extremely playful. Don't urinate outside the box.
Yeah.
Any other suggestions?
Yeah. Here? You know, it's cats that are under 10 years of age. The statistics are less than 2% of cats under 10 have a urinary tract infection. Okay. Something that will respond to antibiotics. And it's just because cats produce such concentrated urine that bacteria doesn't like to grow in it. as they get older, they've got more reasons to develop urinary tract infections. And so that's why it becomes more of an issue for older cats. But these are young cats. You said under a year or so of age. Okay. So, you know, so urinary tract infections, I'd put that down in the very bottom of my list of potential rule outs. But I hope that the veterinarian has looked at getting urine cultures done, taking actually a sterile urine sample directly from the cat's bladder and have it looked at, cultured out to see if anything grows or not. But again, usually a pretty low yield test for some of these younger cats. The top two differentials I would have, one would be bladder stones. And again, you've run the risk of if you get a urine sample and it sits on the counter for a while, you'll see crystals in the urine. Doesn't necessarily mean that that's what the cat is forming. So you have to get a urine sample hot off the press and have it looked at right away. If there's crystals there or there's blood in the urine, getting an x-ray done to look for visible stones or an ultrasound done to look for, you know, stones. That's another thing to be considering doing is looking for stones that may not show up on x-ray. But the two most common types that we see in cats, struvite stones and oxalate stones, show up on an x-ray. So getting an x-ray done may be helpful. The other thing that's a very common diagnosis is this idiopathic feline cystitis. And what that means is that we don't know what causes it. It's usually stress-related. It can come on. The cat may have straining blood in their urine for 5 days, 7 days, and it goes away when the stress disappears. Best thing you can do for those cats is rule out everything else and then keep them cat stress free. Plug in some of the feline facial pheromone in the atomizers. It's called Feel Away. You know, make sure that the cats are not being stressed by outdoor cats or a dog in the household. Give them their own little, you know, sanctuary if that's the case, and push the fluids. Some of these cats do so much better on just switching over to a canned food diet. Nothing special. Doesn't have to be a special diet or anything, but just a canned food diet that can reduce about 30% of the recurrences by doing that. So that would be what I'd be looking at. And yes, they can be expensive to work up, but you know, I think that's time to go back to the vet and say, what haven't we done? And let's see if we can get some answers.
Sally in Wayland, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Sally.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Sandy.
Hi.
Thank you both for helping so many of our beloved critters.
Oh, you're welcome.
Really appreciate it. I have a standard poodle who I love very much, but she is very defective. Her latest defect is when she goes out for her morning poo, she winces and cries as if she's in terrible pain. I need to know what is wrong with her and what can I do to help her?
Well, you know, if again, lunchtime, we got to talk about this, but a couple things come to mind. You know, one, is it the stool that's being passed? Is she constipated? Is she eating a lot of roughage? I mean, I had, you know, I have patients that go out and eat branches and sticks and all kind, and they're trying to pass that kind of stuff, and it can be irritating and bothersome for them. Sometimes we'll have dogs with colitis and inflammation of their colon, and as the stool's being passed, again, it's painful. And so if she's got blood, mucus, foreign material, you know, hard stools, those would be all directions that we'd be looking, you know, trying to figure out why she's got colitis and take it from there. The other thing that comes to mind is the posturing that dogs have to go through for defecating involves a lot of mobility of their lower back, their lumbosacral joint. And she's a large breed dog, and we do see a condition quite commonly called lumbosacral instability, and they can have lower back pain, and that could be what's causing her to wince. So if you're finding that she's painful over her back, that would be the direction I would go in. So I think it really is going to depend on stool quality, what she eats, you know, and then looking for, you know, other reasons for pain. And even, you know, something as simple as checking those anal glands, getting a rectal done to make sure that she doesn't have anything that is causing her discomfort that the stool is trying to get past.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. An email from Candia, who says, wonders, what are your thoughts on corn and byproducts in our pet foods relating to allergies? By nature, dogs and cats are not set up to eat corn, so feeding corn, could we be causing allergies in our pets?
Good question. But, you know, the number one cause of allergies, food allergies I'm talking about, not allergies to pollens and molds, but food allergies, number one allergen is the protein source in the diet. Okay, it's not the corn. No. Corn is a good source of energy. It can be added to the food and be part of the nutritional makeup of the diet. Obviously, to feed just corn is not going to be a balanced diet, but to include it in the diet, it can be an excellent source of nutrition for our pets. If we're suspicious of having a dog or a cat with food allergies, we usually put them on a feeding trial that involves using a hydrolyzed protein source of protein. So they usually take poultry, break it down into little microscopic bits, and that's what's fed to the dog. They're quite expensive, but because it is the protein source that usually causes the problem, that's what we have to do. So I think, people are concerned about corn, but if it's part of the balanced diet, I don't have any problem at all with it.
Stacy in Rice Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sandy. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My mom had a cat, and I'm sorry to say the cat's been since put to sleep, but he had what I would call spells, and every once in a while, he would just turn around and start screaming and attacking his tail and pulling the hair out. And throughout his life, he lived to be about five. His spells became more frequent, and whenever he would want something, when he'd want outside or when he didn't want to use the litter box in the winter, he would have these spells where he'd throw himself down and start attacking himself.
Wow.
And eventually, he started getting aggressive, and it would be just random triggers where, a dog would look at him sideways or make a move towards him, but not have any intention of coming near him. And he attacked my dog and my mom's dog. And then I think the final straw was when he was trying to attack my mom's dog and attacked my mom.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
So yeah. We were worried that he might have one of these just random spells. Or you could tell he wasn't himself.
Right,
but
right.
If he had this with a kid around, we were really worried. And he'd end up putting him to sleep. But after that, I looked up some stuff online, and I came across something called feline hyperesthesia syndrome.
You got it. You found just what I was going to start talking about. Yeah, there's a syndrome that we've coined, feline cat hyperesthesia, hypersensitivity syndrome. And we really don't know how to classify it. If you start looking this up, you will find it written up in behavior books. You will find it written up in neurology textbooks. You will find it written up in dermatology textbooks. These cats tend to have, all cats will do a little twitching over their back and kind of take off every once in a while. These cats hate being touched over their lower back. They tend to be extremely hypersensitive and may turn around and growl and bite at their backside, maybe chase their tail. Some of them will hallucinate and look like they're chasing flies and stuff that aren't there. It's very bizarre behavior. And I've seen it in a handful of cases in my career. Some of the behaviorists feel that these cats would do better on drugs for dealing with compulsive disorders. And so we've tried them on things like Prozac and that kind of stuff. Some neurologists feel that this is some type of a focal motor, like a motor seizure disorder, and feel that it would be a good idea to try them on an anticonvulsant drug like Phenobarb. Dermatologists say, rule out skin problems and maybe consider it's some kind of an allergic problem, put them on steroids. So no, there isn't one treatment that we use for these kitties. And unfortunately, if your cat was to that point where it would redirect its aggression to anybody that was nearby, those are dangerous cats to have around. And whether it's a cat that has a problem like this or it's redirecting its aggression because it saw a cat out the window and now it chases you, oh my goodness. I mean, they are dangerous. And I'm very sorry that you lost your cat, but sometimes there just isn't anything we can do.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if we were going to end up having to go through a bunch of different medications. My mom just decided she didn't want to have to have a liability.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, but some pets do lose their life when a human's safety is at risk.
Yeah. Thank you for calling. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, do you have a quick question?
Actually, I don't have a question. I have a tip for owners of probably cats and maybe small dogs who are heat-loving animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have a kitty who just loves heat, and we use a seedling heat mat on the floor. We use the middle size. They come in three sizes. It's by about 20 inches square.
Uh-huh.
we keep it plugged in. It draws 45 watts. And she just goes over and she'll curl up on it initially, and then she'll sprawl out, and then she'll roll over on the other side, and then she'll get warmer than she likes, and she'll go off on the onto the carpet by the side.
And that's the key, is the cat has to be able to, or dog has to be able to get off of it. Anytime we're using any heating pads, whatever kind we're using, if the pet is debilitated enough that it can't move from it, it can cause burns. And so we have to be really careful with that. And so it sounds like this cat just loves it. Perfect.
Perfect. Yay. Thank you, Stella. Good tip there to close the program. And Dr. Sandy, thank you so much.
Hey, it's great. I'm going to be back on the 20th next month.
October 20th. Mm-hmm. She will be back. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And we have a whole ton of emails and lots of callers online. I'm sorry we didn't get to you and your question. But that's the way it goes sometimes. But she'll be back on the 20th, and we'll start this and do this all over again. Coming up tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about help for Wisconsin farmers. Dan Smith of the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection will be with us at 11. Then at 11:45, John Greenler and Troy Runge will be talking with us about UW Biofuels Research. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.